Deezer Originals.
This is Defending in Numbers.
Welcome, you football-loving mother truckers, to Defending in Numbers, the podcast where we walk down the corridor of uncertainty, pretending to know a little bit more about football than we actually do. My name is Rob Armstrong. I'm a pretender, but I'm joined by two very real and very knowledgeable men. First of all, in the red corner, weighing in at, well, he's given me a dodgy look, so I'm not going to reveal the truth, but the anchor man cometh on his second appearance, Carl Anker. How are you, Carl?
I'm good. Hello, true believers. Let's talk football and stuff.
He wants to talk football, but he needs a third man. And there's a third man in every great trio, because otherwise, by default, it wouldn't be a trio. And today, it's James Benj. Is this your first appearance? It is.
I don't know. I'm always at this. I'm always hanging around the Squawker office waiting for someone to record my voice. But yeah, it's good to be here. I'm rocking the pink corner.
It's our first time in this sweaty room together. Early doors.
I feel great. I feel raring to go. I was not up until silly hours watching basketball. No siree.
Nope, we were both doing that. Not together.
Well, I was up late dreaming of football. I was dreaming of 3 points this weekend for West Ham, which...
It's not going to happen, mate.
Probably won't happen.
Stick to dreaming.
Yeah. And, of course, our listeners are listening out there on Deezer, on iTunes, any of the places where you can get your podcast. Remember to rate, review, subscribe, do everything you can to make Carl incredibly rich.
Please, I need the money. I need to buy the new FIFA game. It's so expensive on Amazon. Why?
His favourite number this week is not FIFA 18. Talking of numbers, let's go to Week by Numbers.
The Week by Numbers.
And the number 90, our first number this week, which is Watford scoring their 90th minute winners in three consecutive games. Sorry, not winners, but decisive goals in three consecutive games. First team to do so in Premier League history, which seems pretty mad to me that there's never been a team that's gone on a run of clutch goals. But there we go, the Hornets. That's what they're all about. Arsenal, though, just kind of... melted, didn't they? Just kind of let them have it, really.
They did their Arsenal. I turned this game on in the 70th minute and Arsenal were 1-0 up, and you just thought, yeah, it'll be kind of a bit boring, but they'll probably be fine. And then they just kind of concertinaed down almost like a season of Arsenal into 20 minutes. Mesut Ozil missed. I kind of think sometimes people are a bit harsh on that. It's not a kind of guaranteed goal scoring chance. I don't know what the XG on it is, but it's not as high as I think people would assume. Gomez is a good keeper. And then Arsenal just arsenaled at the back. It's everything. It's a lack of leadership. Per Mertesacker is that leader, but he hasn't played in, like, he hadn't started a game in 18 months. And then so naive, so easy to kind of get at. Troy Deeney, you know, we've all heard his comments, spot on.
Amazing, amazing comments. It was really refreshing and candid to see a player go, yeah, I'm going to play Arsenal. First thing I'm going to do, I'm going to whack you. And if you don't want it, I know I'm going to have a happy day.
Yeah, you really laid into Mertesacker as well, didn't you? So the first person I go for, Mertesacker, I thought I'm going to have to win this fight. And then he didn't have a fight at all. You just let him have it.
I mean, I feel bad for ragging on Mertesacker because he's really old, but both in he's old in the physical sense and in the footballing sense. He's got a lot of miles on the clock. He's very, very large. He shouldn't really be playing football at the top level anymore. Like, his body can't really cope.
He's only 32 though, isn't he?
He's
33.
He's 33, but he's got a lot of miles on the clock because he's been around for a while. It's sort of how like Podolski's secretly 35 in footballing years because he's been around since the days of Pro Evo 4. But it's not really Per Mertesacker's fault that he is in a position to start for Arsenal. It's Wenger's fault for not having a centre-back.
I think there's things that players like Mertesacker bring that actually almost Arsenal miss his character. And I think if you kind of go back to the FA Cup final, he was the best player on the pitch by miles. But the issue is you can't have like kind of one person. Well, you can have a sort of inspirational captain who can make a real difference to a team. But when the rest of the team is so timid, and going back to those Deeney comments, if he'd said that about Man United, if he'd said that about Chelsea, I mean, he wouldn't in the first place. But the next time Watford faced either of those teams, I'd be wearing shin pads made out of pure steel if I was Deeney. Like, what are Arsenal ever going to do to him? Per Mertesacker comes out the next day and goes, oh, I didn't really listen to what Troy Deeney said. Why are you not listening to that? It's embarrassing.
Why are you a club needing an inspirational captain to get you through a game against Watford? Mm. Now, look, I think Marco Silva is fantastic. Every time he wins a game, I laugh at Paul Merson. I think he is probably, I love bringing in this term when I'm using, it doesn't belong. I think he's pound for pound one of the best, one of the better managers in the Premier League. But Watford are not going to be challenging for the top six, or they're going to, if they have a good season, they'll be eighth. You should not need an inspirational captain to get you past the game against Watford. Tom Cleverley should not be the dynamic man to get you, like to like look like Iniesta carving you up, despite how much Cleverley thinks he is. There was a small clip going doing the rounds on Arsenal Twitter of the Tom Cleverley goal, and the caption was simply, "Look at Xhaka."
Yeah, picking his nose.
Yeah, he's statuesque. He's not moving. He takes a step the moment, like just after Cleverley takes the shot. Xhaka is what, 35 million? He was 35 million at a time when 35 million was a lot of money, yeah. And we still don't know if he's box to box or if he's a defending guy. What is the point of Granit Xhaka in this Arsenal system? I think I was on here previously with a podcast, and I was talking to one Arsenal fan. He said he's sort of the steady Eddie in a midfield. Mm. I'm like, you don't spend 35 million on a steady Eddie.
No, exactly. That's a Mark Noble, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
A steady Eddie. A Tom Cleverley is a steady Eddie.
Yeah.
And you don't have one of them if you think you're the elite. You have to compare yourself to sort of Man City against Watford, right? No, but I mean, if you're wanting to be one of the teams in the Champions League qualification places, if you want to say that you're one of the best teams in the league, you have to compare yourself to the other ones. And if City can go there and win 6-0, I know they're sort of on a bit of a different planet.
Mm-hmm.
But losing 2-1, have a look, have a word.
But we do this every month, don't we? It's, Arsenal. And here are all the myriad problems of Arsenal. It's not going to get fixed. I still can't believe Arsene Wenger has a 2-year contract.
I think the reality is that Arsene Wenger 2-year contract comes down to the sort of fear of anyone at that club about what would really happen if they tried to mix things up. It's why Carlo Ancelotti is going to be the perfect Arsene Wenger successor, because he doesn't do anything. and this club, you know, it just exists to continue existing and to continue making money. I mean, it was before the Bate Borisov game, they released their results, and you kind of got the sense they were more interested in their annual turnover of £400 million than they were about kind of doing anything in any of the competitions. They're just a team that's going to exist around the top six in the Premier League kind of until the end of time. They're not going to win another Premier League for a generation, despite the fact that I actually believe so many of their players, including Granit Xhaka, are capable of winning the Premier League. when Xhaka has his good games, he's outstanding, but you have to come up with a like energetic partner to play alongside him. Arsenal aren't putting the team together correctly, and they're never going to win the league. And they've got a manager that can't get the best out of their players.
So they're going to finish around sixth until the end of time, which was meant to happen in 2012, I believe, which conveniently is the next number. Was it 2012? That was when the world was meant to end, wasn't it? They even made a film of it.
It was fantastic. No, it was not.
2012 was the last time a player scored a hat-trick in the Milan derby before Mauro Icardi this weekend. Inter Milan obviously coming out 3-2 winner there. Diego Milito was the last player to do it, another Inter Milan player. Mauro Icardi, though, is a controversial player at times. Hasn't had the best relationship with the Inter fans, but is something like this enough to prove to them that, you know, he's the world-class player that he wants to be, that people kind of tout him as in the media, or are they still going to have a bit of a fractious relationship?
I think that all is forgiven. Obviously, those comments a year ago, I think it was, in that book, were not particularly intelligent comments to make about a very passionate fan base. But ultimately, if you're a team that's kind of been as average as Inter are for a long time, Mauro Icardi is your kind of only hope. I mean, they're only 3 points off the title, and he is absolutely brilliant. I kind of think once we kind of get past the Lewandowski-Suarez era that we're in now, the two best number nines in the world, pure strikers, are going to be Harry Kane and Mauro Icardi. He's that good. The finish for his second goal, where he kind of, the ball loops a little bit behind him and he somehow swings his right foot with a brilliant volley. It's next level. He's absolutely brilliant. The challenge is he's in such a bad team that we kind of never get to see him do it at the highest level. But I think he's, along with Kane, he's one of the next best number nine.
He's only 24 or 25, isn't he, Cole?
He's a young lad. And he's got that swagger and confidence that you need in number nine. I think to carry on from your point, James, about Harry Kane and like what you need to be a pure number nine. I think Harry Kane believes in the gambler's fallacy. So Kane has apparently Kane goes in, he has a shot, and if the keeper saves it, he goes, that's not a problem. It means I'm more likely to score the next time. Absolute nonsense. That's not how football works at all. But that's the lie Harry Kane tells himself to G himself up for a game. And that's the sort of weird mentality you need from a striker to do stuff. And I think, you know, that comes through when Icardi's doing all these sorts of weird flicks and tricks that shouldn't come off for strikers. And I think if you look a couple of seasons ago when Vardy was on that scoring run and he was doing Galazzos for fun, like the ability that confidence can cut, like what confidence can do to a striker and what happens when you have a young striker who's gone, oh, I can get away with this now. Amazing. Phenomenal.
Yeah. Just don't let him near your wife.
No.
AC Milan, right? They've spent a fortune. What's happening there? Why are they still struggling this year?
Other Italian teams are quite good, would be a starting point. And it always happens, doesn't it? When you spend loads of money, you just can't put together a team that kind of quite clicks and gels. I don't really know what their strongest 11 is. They're still putting Fabio Barini on the pitch as well. So yeah, maybe...
Proven class.
Maybe this never is their failed. Level. Well, if you've got Breen in your team, you're doing well not to get relegated.
I'm not sure if we can call this doing a Spurs anymore, because doing Spurs are now good. But in terms of, oh, we've got loads of money, let's go buy 10 players at once. So Spurs did it after Bell, didn't work so well. Liverpool did it after Suarez, didn't work so well. Everton now done it after selling Lukaku, it's not working so well. AC Milan are doing it, it's not working so well. Trying to bed in five or six players in one transfer window, it's not Football Manager. It's not FIFA. These guys need to learn. You know, these guys come from disparate football cultures. Not all of them speak the same language. Some players come from defensive systems. Some players come from attacking systems. And also, the manager's not very good. I don't know why I've put that in a questioning tone. Their manager's not very good.
Yeah.
If you're AC Milan, go get Ancelotti back. He's free. He'll won't fix it.
Montella?
Yeah, Vincent Montella, who was, you know, a Football Manager hero in the early 2000s and a former Roma man. But he's not a particularly great manager. AC Milan, at the start of the season, I said they'd be lucky to finish in the Champions League places. I'm sticking with that. I think if you're an Italian football fan, please start praying that Napoli win Serie A. But I think it's going to be Napoli, Juve, and then possibly Roma in your top three come the end of the season.
Right then, Carl. Next number is zero. And I'm coming to you. Justify the parking of the bus, because Manchester United made zero chances in the second half against Liverpool. Was it negative? Too negative? Was it getting a good result? Come on, justify it.
I can't. It's too negative. It's too negative.
Okay,
it's,
forget it. End the podcast.
It's look, we all know how Jose approaches big games now. We all know his seven tenets and his like philosophy. So in a big game, the team that makes the most mistakes loses. And you make mistakes more if you have the ball. So therefore, if I don't have the ball, fine. So this was the thing he brought forward at Real Madrid. This is the thing that got him ousted at Real Madrid. We know he likes to spoil and he likes to contain. The problem is that Liverpool team was there for the taking, in my opinion. Like in the weeks lead up, you know, we know they're poor in set pieces. We know they're vulnerable at the back. Yes, they have a very electric front three, but Mane's currently out. Lallana's currently out. Their midfield... with, you know, the midfield options are limited now because you have to play Coutinho in the final three. So you've got Emre Can, Giorgio Wijnaldum and Jordan Henderson. That's not a very pacey middle three. And you've got, you know, within Manchester United, you have some personnel that can really damage that side. And he went to Anfield, he applied the handbrake and I was like, oh, well, fine. Like it was acceptable last season because we didn't have the personnel. We didn't really have the personnel to do stuff. And yes, Pogba's not around. But come on, man. Give me something, Jose.
It's anti-football. It's anti-football. I don't necessarily believe that it's even particularly difficult to set up. As he's admitted, the easiest thing in the world is to set up a team to draw 0-0. Like, just show a bit of ambition. I know that, you know, club identity means nothing in 2017, except as a way of selling noodles in the Far East. But, like, you're Manchester United. You have these phenomenal wingers. Like, give it a go. If I was a Man United fan, I would be fuming at Jose Mourinho because he spoils all the games you look forward to. As a non-Man United fan, I don't even turn on their big games on TV because I'm just like, I'd rather watch paint dry than watch Man United.
Louis van Gaal was there at Anfield covering the game for Dutch television, and Van Gaal did not lose against Liverpool in his time in the league at least as Manchester United manager. And you know, halfway through second half, you're going, Van Gaal would have done something. He would have rotated the fullbacks or like played Ashley Young as a false nine. He'd have done something. Mm. And I think what's particularly important is the way the league's looking and the way Manchester City are playing. It's looking like whoever will win the league this year will be on track to get 90 points plus. And if Mourinho does this approach to all of the big games where he looks to spoil and get a point, he's not going to get that 90 points. He's not going to get the necessary points that we need to get to win the league. You know, people talk about this mini league of the top six teams are playing against each other. If Jose does his thing, he's like, I'm just going to get a point in all these games and try and destroy all the others. Like, if you draw three games against top six teams, yeah, you get 3 points. If you lose two games and win two in the other six, in against playing the other top six, you get six. Come on, like, dare to dream. You can't just rely on hammering West Ham 4-0. Sorry, mate.
Cheers, mate. No, it's quite a lot of teams to consider as big teams as well. Now, there's five other teams. That's, you know, if you're one of the top six, it's five other teams. It's the same as any club in the league. Can't just say, well, we'll settle for whatever we can against the top six. Top two, yeah, okay, maybe you take what you can against the top, but top six,
yeah,
it's more than the quarter of the league. It's more, it's ridiculous. You can't just sort of settle against that higher portion of the league.
That's 10 games. That's 10 games you're looking to draw.
I can't wait till he tries against Man City and gets absolutely stonked. Like, he did it at Real Madrid against that Barcelona team, and maybe sometimes it paid off, but sometimes he got battered.
We know he can do better. To bring up, you know, he's going to bring up, as Jose does, is want to do, you're going to criticise him for taking a defensive approach, and he will most likely now bring up, well, you know, I beat Chelsea 2-0 last season. And you're like, yeah, because you played a counter-attacking game with a pacey striker and you were doing loads of through balls. Do that. Be more ambitious, please. He's recently been in the press talking about how he might leave Manchester United, or he doesn't see his career ending at Manchester United unless Manchester United is... unless his remuneration matches his achievements at Manchester United. Jose Mourinho gets 15 million a year and he wants more money for taking Manchester United to sixth in the league and winning the Europa League after spending 300 million. As a contrast, Mario Pochettino gets just over 5 million a year and he's taking Spurs, the incredibly Spursy Spurs, to a very well-drilled 1-1 draw against Real Madrid. Jose's talking guff, mate.
He got that sort of two bob treble though. What was it? League Cup, Community Shield, and Europa League.
The bronze treble.
Oh. I'd do anything for one of them. Next number 41. That's the number of home league games Juventus and Borussia Dortmund had both won in a row before losing to Lazio and RB Leipzig, Rasenball Sport Leipzig, respectively. So Juventus, certainly, it looks like the unbeatable Juventus may be starting to shake a little bit this year. Borussia Dortmund, obviously, it's a bit of a different situation. They've certainly not been dominant in the league for a while, not since they won it back with Klopp. But Juventus, especially, does it look like they might be sort of waning a little bit now?
Yeah, I think it's strange, isn't it? Because every year they lost like one of their best players, Pogba, Tevez, Pirlo, Vidal. All of those players went, and Juventus kept getting better. But Bonucci's out the door now, and there's just no one you can find to replace Bonucci, except John Stones, maybe. and it, you know, without that, you know, they're just a little bit more cumbersome, a little bit more. They just kind of exist a bit more. I mean, they've still got probably, you know, one of the best forwards in the world in Dybala, and if he'd scored that penalty, things look so different. But yeah, it's just without that one player who can start their attacks, it's a completely different team. It'd be like if you took David Luiz out of Chelsea. You know, there's just, it's all a bit meh without Bonucci. And I think the fact that Napoli are playing this kind of, you know, Sarri ball, you know, explosive, brilliant football, I do think that Juventus are really going to struggle to keep up, because you've also got teams like Inter, Roma. I know we said that Milan are a bit rubbish, but, you know, if they can get things together,
potential.
There's a lot of teams that can knock points off Juve. I think we're seeing a really exciting changing of the guard in Italy. Don't know about Germany.
Yeah, what do you reckon, Carl? Have you seen... Because I think they were missing Pjanic as well, weren't they, the other day? And how much does he make things tick? Are they missing him? Is it a case of wrong players missing? But Michi hasn't been setting the world alight at Milan by any accounts, has he?
I mean, it's a case of the personnel they've got to replace some of these big players. So when they lost Pogba, they got Pjanic. Pjanic did an able job last season. They've lost Bonucci. That's a big loss. They also lost your man who now plays for PSG and is Neymar's best friend.
Dani Alves.
And that dramatically limits how well they can play in wide positions. So that, you know, it's strange to think that the 32-year-old Dani Alves gives your team a pacey outlet, but they did. Higuain's gone off the boil a bit as well. I think that's very important. Because very much the plan for Juve for the last couple of seasons is we're going to go all in, try and win stuff now, and we'll deal with the repercussions a bit later on. And they've got an estate a bit similar to Pellegrini and Pellegrini's Manchester City, where you've got a lot of old, aging internationals that you bought so you can win trophies now. And now they're all approaching 29 to 32. And they're going, oh no, the win now phase has ended and we've got to start a new cycle. I mean, Juve, they're a big enough brand. I love their brand new kit. I love their brand new badge. They're going to start selling more tickets around the world. So they're going to be there or thereabouts in the next couple of years. I don't think this is a crisis. I will say, if you are a football, you know, air quotes, footballing hipster, try and buy tickets for Napoli's last game of the season. Because if Napoli do it, you're going to want to be there. Because if you look at, look, a bit of homework for you football fans, go get your smartphone out. Look up images of when Napoli last won Serie A, and there's a fantastic photograph of Maradona giving it large. You're going to want to see that in person.
Reckon they'll wheel him out again.
Yeah, oh yeah, he'll be there. He'll be there texting, calling Pele such and such and whatnot.
I was in Naples at the weekend, actually. It's just mental. Go there. Like, strange city, but like the most football mad city.
A lot of stray dogs. A lot of graffiti. Stray dogs. Go there. A lot of fun. Stay safe.
Yeah, get your rabies shots from the street. Keep yourself safe from those stray dogs. Quick word on Dortmund as well. So they lost to RB Leipzig. RB Leipzig, of course, won in the Champions League on Tuesday. Dortmund drew to Apoel, which is not the best of results for them. You really want to be beating them both times in the group if you want to achieve anything.
Yeah.
Does it look like Leipzig is now the team that might be the challenger, so to speak?
I think Leipzig are going to be the third team. So what you've got now is Bayern went off the ball because of Ancelotti's, you know, deck chair style approach to coaching. They've got Juk back. Bayern will be back very soon. I wouldn't be surprised if Bayern will be on top come Christmas, because like Daniel Alaba, Jerome Boateng and Thomas Müller are suddenly going to rediscover how to play football again. Dortmund's draw says a lot, has a lot to do with Apoel's great defending. I think something very interesting is Dortmund already have a 17% chance of winning the Europa League baseline. Like if you pull the math, 17% chance of winning the Europa League. So I wouldn't be surprised if Boateng goes, fine. Like, we'll finish third and we'll go in all in the Europa League and we'll probably beat Arsenal in the final, which is cool. Bundesliga is going to get reasonably interesting. I think Red Bull's performance against Porto on Tuesday night was... some of the goals they worked. You know, they went 3-1 up very, very quickly. And their second and third goals were really just like well drilled, really, really high press, great through ball. And you're going, all right, these boys can play. But I think the squad's too thin. Naby Keita, of course, going to Liverpool either in January if Liverpool get scared, or next season. So I think it's a bit too soon to say Red Bull going to win the Bundesliga.
Yeah. Do you reckon, James, that they've got a lot of young players, haven't they? They've got a really good youth policy, but it might put them in danger of... Obviously, Dortmund actually had the same problem, didn't they? They're basically, their best player gets nicked by Bayern every year. A Red Bull just going to get...
Well, I mean, they do have the advantage that they've got like Red Bull money behind them. You know, having the world's biggest energy drink behind you does, I guess, help you stave off your rivals.
But it gives you wings, apparently.
It does. But I'm not sure, you know, continuing that metaphor, I'm not sure they're kind of really ready to fly on to the next level yet, because someone will go for Emil Forsberg as well in the summer. And like, I think I get the feeling they're going to be a team that does their best to fight these things off. But, you know, when it's, let's say, whether it's Man City, Man United, Arsenal, whoever goes for Forsberg is going to be willing to pay a lot of money. And that's the thing, they're just going to have to start again. And as Dortmund have shown that, it wears you down, like constantly having to buy new players and rebuild your squad, no matter how good your front office is at reinvigorating your roster. It just, it'll get too much.
Okay. Now I've got a number for you here. A nice little bit of stat info stuff. It's the number 2.5. It's not that interesting a number, but it's the rate of goals per game Man City need to score from now until the end of the season to break the record for most goals in a season. Now, considering the fact that they are definitely going to win another game 7-something or 8-something, do you reckon they can do it? Because they put 7 past Stoke, who are meant to be hard to score against, but I'm not sure how much that sort of myth has been true in the last few years.
Stoke weren't bad. It's just Manchester City are transcendent. Jonathan Liu, now chief football writer for The Independent, wrote a fantastic write-up of the pass Kevin De Bruyne played to Leroy Sané before the Sterling goal, where Sané's run down the byline. He's passed it back to De Bruyne. De Bruyne's turned. There is no way De Bruyne can see Sané's made the run back to the byline. De Bruyne's chipped the ball back to Sané. Sané's just like passed it back to Sterling. And you're going, Kevin De Bruyne's maybe top 0.001% of footballers. And what's even more terrifying is De Bruyne did a similar move against Napoli on Tuesday night. Like, De Bruyne can do this. He must have eyes in the back of his head.
I love to seeing you try and demonstrate that while sat in a corner of a room.
There's a lot of like,
I don't know if you can hear the sort of shuffling,
pulling motions I'm doing right now. I mean, the thing about Manchester City now is you've got, if Sergio Aguero doesn't get you, Gabriel Jesus will get you. If those two won't get you, Sane or Sterling will get you. If those two won't get you, then David Silva will get you. If David Silva won't get you, then Kevin De Bruyne will get you. And if those two won't get you, Kyle Walker will whip across it. And if that doesn't get you, apparently John Stones can score goals now.
I just think we're probably... You hate to kind of engage in this hyperbole because part of you just wants to sit back and enjoy this amazing football team. But I think this may well end up being the greatest team we've seen in Premier League history. I just think all they need to do is carry on at this level. And I know blah, blah, blah. Yeah, they were like this at the start of last season and fell apart. But
I was about to make that point. I'm glad you would have met it with blah, blah, blah.
Blah, 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 blah. But God, they're just transcendent. It's just a joy to watch them. Like, you know, I, dear Sky Sports and BT Sports, I don't care about the sanctity of 3 o'clock kickoffs. Put them on TV every week. They are amazing.
Even Fabian Delph is good now.
Yeah, I threw him in my fantasy league. No one saw it coming.
Something I find amazing is, you know, people were saying, oh, why doesn't Delph leave Man City? And he's like, no, I'm getting coaching. I'm getting coached for the first time in years. I'm getting intensive drills. If you look at some of the moves City are pulling together, you can, if you watch them enough, you can see they've got 4 or 5 passing drills that they do for like repeatedly on the pitch. You can go, oh, they're doing like Omega 3 or Epsilon 4. Like, clearly they look at each other, we're going to do this passing move right now. You stand there, you stand there, you stand there, and you're going, oh man, this is going to get a shot on goal. Christ, they're good. You can only, as a United fan, look, I know I shouldn't wish injuries upon someone, but the only thing that looks like will stop Man City is probably an injury.
Or 11.
Yeah. Or you get that weird problem where you reveal too many of your weapons too early. So come the tail end of the season, you've got a manager like Poch going, okay, I've seen like your plan A, your plan B, your plan C. I can now negate all of them. But then you've got Pep who can go, all right, I'll just spend the whole week turning Gundogund into the greatest false nine you've ever seen in your life.
Basically, Man United's hope is a lot of rogue taxi drivers.
Yeah, pretty much. rest up, Aguero. Rest up.
I think he's all right. He's back on the bench now.
He was.
All right, let's move on then. Too embarrassed to ask.
I'm embarrassed to ask.
Right then. I don't want to look like too much of a ignorant England fan who believes that we deserve to be considered as the best team in the world all the time just on account of we've got 3 Lions, which is a really good song. But
World in Motion's better.
World in Motion is better. The John Barnes rap. To use a word we've already been using, transcendent. Transcendent rapping from John Barnes. But why aren't England in pot one? Because we won our group by a mile. So surely that should put us at least in some kind of advantageous position when it comes to the pots. But now we might end up in a group with Brazil or someone like that that's definitely going to beat us.
Because we're so rubbish at organising a football team that we manage to constantly ruin our FIFA world ranking. And yeah, the FIFA world rankings are all nonsense, except for the fact that FIFA then use them to decide the pots. And we are now going to end up in a group with like Brazil, Mexico and Australia, and we're going to get no points and we'll last about 5 days because we keep playing these friendly. We're like, oh, you know what would be really good for Dele Alli, a prestige friendly, and then we get tonked 2-0, played off the pitch by France, Germany and all that lot, and FIFA go, yeah, you know, this is going to knock off your international ranking. We've only just moved above Wales, who had this incredibly smart tactic of let's not play friendlies ever, and let's definitely not play them against teams we're going to lose to and destroy our own world ranking. Like, I do see a logic in, you know, building some sort of match readiness and familiarising Eric Dier with what it's going to be like when Neymar runs at him. But if you're going to lose all these games, you've got to realise it's going to absolutely destroy your chances of getting in pot one. And I remember, you know, 2006 and all that lot, and 2010 as well, we got such easy groups because we are in pot one. I mean, we might have managed to screw them up, but we had easy groups.
Why are England pot two? Because England are a second tier footballing nation. Is the blunt, like, let's put a
cold hard truth.
Yeah, let's get rid of all the pomp and circumstance. All right, Euro 2016, we get knocked out in the round of 16 against Iceland. World Cup 2004, we don't get out of the group. Euro 2002, we get knocked out in the quarterfinals against Italy. World Cup 2010, we get absolutely hockeyed by Germany. We don't make Euro 2008. Euro 2004. Again, a disaster. Look, England will win 9 out of 10 games in their qualifying. They will probably win most of their game because when you're the hardest team in your qualifying group is Switzerland, you got a good chance. But in terms of proven when it counts, this is what we can do. England aren't very good. There's a fantastic book, Why England Lose, by the people that made Freakonomics, that says if you equate a win to mean 1 point and a draw to mean half a point, from the post-war period, England, on average, win about half of their games. So you get that streak where you're like, okay, amazing, we've won 10 games in a row. Oh, it's the World Cup and we've lost two and drawn one. Like, England are in pot two because England deserve to be in pot two. And you can bring up friendlies, which, yes, it's a problem. England should play less friendlies, but that's not going to be a thing because we've got Club Wembley. And you can bring up the fact that England play far too many games against prestigious opposition. But that says a lot more about the fact that England should have a better team to play these oppositions. If your thing is we shouldn't keep playing Germany because we're rubbish, your solution isn't to stop playing Germany in friendlies. Your solution is how do we get as good as Germany? How do we get the coaches in place? Like, England reaping what they sow, and I can't wait to watch them in the World Cup next year.
I know, I'm so excited. Oh, it's going to be so painful.
Hey, we already won one this year. We don't need another one next year. We've got that under 20 World Cup. I don't need the other World Cup.
Exactly. We're still in the under 17s. Won a penalty shootout.
But this is what's mad about it. It's like we are at youth level, in spite of everything, in spite of the, you know, the academy system, in spite of the lack of playing fields in London. I mean, God knows how Croydon and Lewisham keep producing all these amazing footballers, as I was talking about with Carl earlier. Like, the quality at youth level is unquestionably there. And like, but Ademola Lookman is the perfect example. He was best player at the under 20 World Cup. He might not have won the award, but he was. And he can't get a game at Everton. And he is so clearly just what Everton need. But, you know, no one in the Premier League backs English young players. We're going to take a string of half-baked, you know, England internationals to the World Cup. They're all going to be either knackered or completely lacking in first team football, like Jack Wilshere. And
Jack Wilshere's making the World Cup. I can't believe it.
And then, you know, we'll just fall apart again. Like, the talent is there at youth level to be developed. I don't know how on earth you then get it into the England team and get the England team working.
I'm going to whisper it. B teams in the Football League.
Yeah, it's just ugh. Wrong.
It's just wrong.
Just putting it out there.
Not Bobby, he's crawled away from the microphone there. He knows the obvious fight back that he's going to get from an Oxford United fan or something in a minute. Yeah. Well, you were saying about our youth being that good. We've had Jadon Sancho, who's been pulled out of the under 17 team to go back to Dortmund, haven't we? Because they want him to play in. I can't remember what it is. Is it they want him to play in the youth Champions League stages?
Get lost, Dortmund. Don't you be doing that. Jadon Sancho's awesome, and I want him playing for England. Yeah, but I mean, huge credit to players. I think almost our best hope is players like, and you've seen a lot of them this summer, Jadon Sancho, Chris Willock, Reece Oxford. They've all gone elsewhere.
Nathan Chabalo as well.
Yeah.
Loftus-Cheek.
All of them are going, right, sitting in a top club's under 23 team is doing nothing for me, particularly the ones that are going to Europe. I just think that's really encouraging, and that's our best hope. A huge credit to them as well, because they're probably taking massive pay cuts. I know that Chris Willock was offered a deal at Man City, could have gone to Man City. I know that for a fact, and he chose to go to Benfica, which is, you know, I don't know the money, but I suspect he wouldn't have earned, he's not earning anywhere near as much. If our players go and do that and then they come back with this continental education, it'd be so good for our team. I mean, we're still probably not going to win the World Cup, but, you know, we might make the quarterfinals, and I'd take Tim Henman level achievements right now.
Do you remember the days of the quarterfinals? I remember when it was like, oh, we'll get to the quarterfinal and lose on penalties again.
Quiet fist pump, my friend.
Those were the days. Those days of failure that wasn't quite as dramatic as our failure these days. All right then. On to the next section. Let's cheer up. Who's this fella?
Who's this fella?
All right then, lads. Talk to me about Malcolm. And I'm not talking about Frankie Muniz. I've no interest in sitcoms from 10 years ago. I want to know...
What's longer than that, mate?
Do you reckon Malcolm in the Middle?
It's longer than 10 years ago. Nearly 20.
In terms of initial broadcast, it's longer than 10 years ago.
All right, forget Who's This Fella. Malcolm in the Middle was 20 years ago.
I reckon it premiered about 20 years ago.
Frankie Muniz must be about 33.
Yeah.
That's Agent Cody Banks to you.
Agent Cody Banks.
That is.
And Agent Cody Banks too. He played both of those characters.
What a sequel.
So well. But this Malcolm we're talking about, apparently, I'm told, has 5 goals and 4 assists in 9 League A games. And he's Brazilian. So it's another one of these brilliant young Brazilians that are coming through. It looks like they might be sort of back to where they were maybe when I was growing up a little bit. Because you've got Gabriel Jesus as well, who's the only player who has scored more than him in Europe under 21. So how good is Malcolm going to be?
Good. Like, wow. So he's just signed to Bordeaux. He signed to Bordeaux for relative peanuts. He went for 5 million euros from Brazil. And he's well good. He's he's nominally a winger. But he can play anywhere in the attacking three in your 4-2-3-1. So he can play left, he can play right. He will eventually get good and be good enough to play as your 10 in that sort of way that Eden Hazard can sort of play as a 10. He's very good taking shots from afar, really, really backs himself. And he's got that little Robin-esque, I'm going to cut inside and have a go. I've been watching a lot of Liga on recently purely because I want to see Mbappe break people's ankles for PSG. But Malcolm, I think the best compliment I can give to Malcolm right now is he should have been the player Dortmund bought to replace Ousmane Dembele. Because he's the sort of, if you looked at Ousmane Dembele last year, I'm really, he's like, I'm strong, I'm quite tall, I'm pacey, I love taking it past players in that style. Like Malcolm either should go to Dortmund soon, or Dortmund are kicking themselves that they didn't buy him already. Add him to your football manager teams, add him to your FIFA career mode. He's a decent lad.
It's interesting how Brazil, I suppose a lot of countries do, but they're really going in these like cycles of now there are so many exciting like kind of winger come strikers. Like you've not just got Malcolm and Gabriel Jesus, like Richarlison absolutely destroyed Arsenal at the weekend. And obviously like these are kind of all like post Neymar players. None of them are at that standard, but then like no one other than a couple of players in the world are. I really like prefer this version of Brazil to like 10 years ago when they were just making a string of like Kleberson, Gilberto Silva.
all more or less retired at 25 to go and drink beer.
Huge wrecking ball midfielders are not Brazil to me. Players like Malcolm are like, they're Brazil. They're the Brazil I was brought up on and they're the Brazil I want. Keep it going.
So what's that front sort of, well, I mean, what's the attack of Brazil going to be for the next 10 years? It's going to be Neymar, Gabriel Jesus,
and Malcolm. You can do that. You can do that in a 4-3-3 with those three up front. So you have Neymar and Malcolm playing off Gabriel Jesus, which is frightening. Or you can, if you want to do a 4-2-3-1, you have, you know, Gabriel Jesus as your tip of your spear, maybe Neymar operating as the 10, and then you have Gabriel Jesus as your tip of your spear. You've got Neymar as your 10. You've got Malcolm on the right, and then you can possibly have Coutinho on the left. And Brazil looked really bad in qualifying up until they got Tite, and then they went on a run. I think they won 8 games in a row. I think the World Cup might be just too early for them to make them a top 3 favourite. But yeah, provide if they get a good run, they're a lock for the semi-finals. Maybe Brazil might be back.
You look very sceptical when said it, and then you say it, and apparently it's fine.
It's one of those things where, do you know, it's every now and again, a football nation just suddenly have a good team, and they haven't planned it. They haven't planned it in the way that... So when Germany went, right, we had a rubbish Euro 2000, let's start planning. So come 15 years from now, we've got a great generation of kids. And now we're seeing that now in World Cup 2014, in the Euros and whatnot. So they planned it. France have planned it. They've got Clairefontaine. They've got their centre of excellence. Right. Belgium didn't plan it. So come World Cup 2014, someone went, Vince and company, why are all these good Belgian players come together? And he's like, oh, I don't know. It's just like a freak accident. And I think that's happening to Brazil, because Brazil went through a lot of trouble. Brazil sort of earmarked World Cup 2014 as the World Cup they were going to win it. And there were so many players that were meant to play in that World Cup that didn't make it. So, Pato should have played in that World Cup. Adriano should have been one of the elder statesmen. Even guys like Joe and Alano should have been there or thereabouts, and they just didn't disappear. So all the things after 2014 was, oh my God, we lost 7-1. Where's the next generation going to come? There needs to be a total root and branch reform of Brazilian football. We need to start thinking more like European. Oh, wait, who are all these attacking players? This is amazing. Oh, we're fine. Oh, well, yeah, we'll make the semi-finals now. And that's what's happened. So I don't want to say Brazil are back, because they haven't planned it. They've just got a good manager, and suddenly someone discovered 4 great kids in the barrios.
Yeah. Also, I mean, you know, if we do talk about Brazil and the World Cup, they are not going to be over that 7-1. Like, that is going to... I mean, it's going to haunt them forever. But this World Cup... you just know that they're going to draw Germany, and you know it's going to be too much for them. Yeah. You know that's going to happen.
Germany aren't looking so good. I'm going to just say that in this high-pitched voice. I'm not sure if it's going to come through in the podcast.
Yeah, but they've been playing their B team for the last year, haven't they?
For people listening to that on headphones. Having yeah,
to imagine if they put that voice on 1.5 speed.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. But, the 7-1 is an absolute disaster, and it will probably... I mean, that's going to go one of two ways. Either it's going to scar the Brazilian football nation, or it's going to create a generation of Bruce Waynes who are like, I have to avenge this. I have to avenge this defeat one day. Stick them both in the group together. Please, FIFA. I know you can do it. Allegedly.
Bend the rules. Bend the rule. We know FIFA would never bend the rules, but just this time. All right, then. Let's move on to the final section. Stat Showdown.
Stat Showdown.
Okay, then. Here we are in a standoff. Two gunslingers of the statistical variety staring each other down. Me, just a humble witness and judge. So pretty much the most important person here, I'd say, more or less. Carl, as a man who's done a Stat Showdown before, you're going second.
Hey.
James, it's best out of three. Impress me with some stats. Because I'm an ordinary person. I'm not a statistician. And I need some kind of ammunition when I go and tell friends, look how much I know about football. Give me a bite-sized stat.
Your friends are going to love this one.
That's the Sunday, kind of intro that I need.
Sunday, 12:30, you're sitting down, you put on Everton versus Arsenal. Everyone's going, oh, I don't fancy Arsenal for this one. They're a mess, as per. And you say to them, right, friends, so-called friends, do you know... Arsenal have beaten Everton more times than any other club has beaten any other club in the history of the English Football League. 94 wins. They're only 6 away from 100 times beating Everton. So it's literally the most surefire win in English Football League history. Might not be the most surefire win.
That has set a high bar, Carl, but you don't believe in just setting the bar. You are the bar. Raise it.
One good Arsenal fact deserves another. So, 12:30, you're going to sit down. You're going to see the lineup. Wenger's going to do a Wenger, so he's probably going to start Per Mertesacker again. Right, here's the thing. Per Mertesacker's start against Watford was the very first time the Arsenal club captain started a league match against opposition since the 22nd of November 2014 when Mikel Arteta started against Manchester United. Yeah.
Those are two great Arsenal stats.
I don't want to improve his stat, but I wrote a lengthy feature about Arsenal's captaincy. That's the first time in 109 Premier League games that Arsenal have named a club captain in their starting lineup.
Yep.
110, actually.
Leadership. Bit of a problem.
Okay. James has got beginner's luck. Yes. He's gone 1-0 up.
Ooh.
He provided a little bit of extra. I mean, I don't agree with butting in on someone else's stat, but he did.
It's fine.
He Sweet. Did. And I'm going to give him that 1-0 lead. Carl, come back. Come back at him, bro.
All right. Here's a new stat. West Brom will be playing away to Southampton this weekend. Southampton are notoriously flaky at scoring goals right now. So I'm going to give you a little scoring stat about West Brom. West Brom have scored 47 goals from set pieces since Tony Pulis took over. 47.
Wow, that's a lot of goals.
That's a lot of goals. That's Tony Pulis really loves penalty areas and like hurting them.
All right then. Carl's put his Tony Pulis cap on for that stat. What have you got, James?
I'm going to North London for my stat. Liverpool Tottenham this weekend. Well, Tottenham Liverpool, in fact.
Wembley Stadium. A very North London.
A very, very North London. And Wembley Stadium could become the 53rd different ground that Liverpool have won at in the Premier League era. And that's a Premier League record.
It's good. It's a good stat, James. It's a lot of stadiums. Liverpool have been a good team for a long time, though. I'm thinking Tony Pulis's cap gets this one.
Yes! Fresh Adidas trainers as well.
Imagine Always saying no to fresh. Tony Pulis.
Yeah. Mr. Club Shop himself. James, you get the first shot in the final round of this stat showdown.
I'm going deep stats.
Whoa.
Going dark stats.
Deep stat diving. Ooh.
The dark web of stats. I'm sure no one is quite as outraged about Leicester City sacking this manager as they were the last one. But I think Craig Shakespeare might be a bit miffed when I point out that Leicester are one of only seven teams in the Premier League with a positive expected goals differential. And their XG for the season overall is plus 1.51, meaning they should theoretically, if they had decent strikers, have a goal difference of plus one or plus two, which is good. That's good. But I can beat that stat. Chelsea's XG for the season, minus 0.5.
Ooh.
Deep stats.
It's good. Spicy. Stats. It's two stats. I'm objectioning here, but yeah.
It's a good stat, but Carl, that was very deep stats.
Very
I don't know. It's how you tell them. And I don't know if I can tell them like that because I've forgotten all the numbers involved already. So, Carl, I reckon there's an opening here. I think he's left a nice fleshy part for you to aim your stat bullet at.
I'm going
to
get my stat bullet. And also, it's a nice little reminder. There's a Friday kickoff this weekend. So change your fantasy football team early. If you listen to this, change it early because on Friday, Brighton go off and they play West Ham.
At the home of football.
At the home of football.
And popcorn.
£9 popcorn. The London Stadium. Brighton, they're going to be relying on the main man, Pascal Gross. Who has been involved in 83% of their goals this season with two goals and three assists. So, fantasy football people, change your team early. And if you reckon Brighton are going to do it, you want to get Pascal in your side.
See, that felt like advice. More than a stat. But I can remember the numbers 2 and 3. Whereas, James, I can't remember any of the numbers you gave me.
Well, it's one of them bloody football hipsters. Numbers.
So, Carl, you're the winner.
Victory!
And the best prize you could ever get from anything is being able to tell the people where they can find you on the internet first.
They can find me at Anchorman616 via Twitter. I also have my own football podcast, which is called Talking Tactics. We go live every single Tuesday morning. So we're sometimes funny, sometimes serious, but always football. So check that out as well.
And James, where can people find you?
They can find me on Twitter at James Benj. They could briefly find me on Facebook, but I shut that down because I can't be dealing with more than one social media page. So just Twitter. I'm just on Twitter.
But if you have one day to go on any Facebook profile ever, go on it before it's shut down. No one else is going to see it. It's going to be a relic soon. You can find me on Twitter at @RobArmstrong_WH. And you can find yourselves on Deezer or iTunes, where you're listening now, and all other podcast places. Share it, like it, review it, rate it, all the good stuff. And we'll see you next week on Defending in Numbers.
Defending in Numbers is a Deezer Originals production. You can find and download more episodes on Deezer and all major podcast providers.